Hello, my name is Chip Ling, and you are listening to Total EM. This time, we have another EMID podcast, so that means you'll be hearing Patrick Bafuma interviewing, this time, Dr. Valerie Vaughn. This will be technically two parts, but they will be broken up by a few weeks, and that's because they're going to talk about two very different things. This time, it's going to be about asymptomatic bacteriuria and nudges, but let's just dive right into the podcast.
Tell me a bit about yourself, how long you've been at University of Michigan, and how'd you get into ID research?
I'm actually a hospitalist physician by training. So I've been at the University of Michigan since medical school, and then I did a research fellowship in hospital medicine a few years back. And so got a master's in health services research at that point through the Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholars Program, and stayed on at the University of Michigan to work with this collaborative called the Michigan Hospital Medicine Safety Consortium, which is what most of my work that people have seen is based from. So it's this collaborative of 46 hospitals across the state that's really doing great patient safety work. And one of the initiatives they are doing is around antibiotic prescribing. And so I'm the lead hospitalist for that initiative. And I've been really interested in two things. One is diagnostic error and how that relates to antibiotic overuse. And then the other is how to improve prescribing as patients leave the hospital.
How'd you fall into ID? Is it just something you were passionate about? Is it just like the opportunity presented itself and you were interested in research? Like, how'd you get in?
Yeah, so the thing I love most about kind of infectious diseases and stewardship, I think more in general, is that you can use it to study behavior and sociology and the way people think, because it's really hard to do diagnosis. It's really hard to kind of weigh the risks and benefits of antibiotics and the culture, the way physicians deal with uncertainty, the way patients deal with uncertainty, all really affect the way we prescribe. And so I think that's what's most interesting about it to me, is kind of the things that antibiotic use teaches you about how we are as humans and how you can kind of use different kind of social psychology lessons that they've applied to other things to actually change how people prescribe.
You strike me as a person who has, your podcast list probably includes things like Freakonomics and other things on human behavior. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, for sure.
So I want to say it was them. They talk a fair amount about nudges. And there's a guy, I want to say he's at Duke, who looks more at nudges for finance. Dan Ariely.
Yeah.
Name's familiar to you?
Name is quite familiar. I'm not quite cool enough to know him personally, but the name is definitely familiar.
A lot of this stuff actually intrigues me as well. So this is not that we have similar past, but I think sort of similar mindsets where it's an interesting look at human behavior. Yeah, so I'm curious to kind of pick your brain on nudges, et cetera. You work a lot on the nudges for asymptomatic bacteria and how to improve patient care. And so could you tell us first about what the concept of a nudge is and how we can get it into medicine.
So nudges are a concept that has really become popular in behavioral economics and social psychology. It's this way of thinking about how people can be influenced. And perhaps my favorite definition of a nudge comes from Richard Thaler, who actually won the Nobel Prize in Economics for a lot of his work in this area back in 2017. What he really said is that a nudge is any aspect of the choice architecture that alters someone's behavior in a predictable way without forbidding any options or changing their economic incentives. And so this is kind of a complicated definition, but what this really means in real life terms is that a nudge is anything that purposely sets up pressures to influence people to make one choice over another. And I think the key thing here is that it's not a financial bonus or a financial penalty. It's really just trying to alter the way someone interacts with the system to make them more likely to choose one thing over another. And so examples of this really abound in our actual lives. You know, people in marketing have been doing this for a long time to try to get us to buy one thing or buy another. One example that's really powerful is what we call the default option. So let's say, for example, you really want people to become organ donors. Now, if you ask them as they're coming in to get their driver's license, would you like to become an organ donor? If so, you need to sign this piece of paperwork. They're less likely to say yes than if you walk in and say to them, you know, We're automatically going to set you up as an organ donor. But if you'd like not to be, you can sign this piece of paperwork and opt out. So just framing it as either opting in, opting out, and setting a default is really powerful to get people to say, okay, well, sure, I guess if everyone else is doing it, if the normal thing to do is to be an organ donor, I will too. And so that's one really powerful option. Even just the way that you set things up, like which option comes first, which option is bolded, which option people see first, makes them more likely to choose things. And the key to nudges is that you're never going to change someone's mind with a nudge if they have a really strong opinion. You know, if someone believes that organ donation is against some personal moral belief, you know, they're going to opt out. But if you have someone who walks in and maybe they've never thought about it before, they haven't made a decision one way or the other, that simple default idea is going to actually really be persuasive and make them probably choose the default. And so you really get to retain autonomy, which is really important for physicians here, because you really can't go around telling doctors what to do. That doesn't work so well. So nudges are nice because it allows doctors, physicians to keep doing what they want to do if they believe strongly in it. But if they come to a place where, you know, maybe they don't have a preformed belief or they don't have a really strong opinion, they can be really powerful in creating behavior change.
So how does this potentially apply to something like antibiotic stewardship, which I understand is something that you're passionate about? Say for something like asymptomatic bacteria or for urine cultures, how do you avoid reflexively writing scripts, and how can we decrease getting urine cultures done in the first place?
Yeah, so there are lots of really great nudges that have been studied when it comes to urine culture stewardship or diagnostic stewardship, this idea of trying to get cultures or diagnostic tests to be used more appropriately. And some of the first ones were actually done around urine cultures. The biggest example I can think of is just taking them off of order sets. You know, if you are going to admit a patient, or let's say in your heart failure order set, there's a urinalysis or a urine culture that's just there. And maybe when you went to write orders, you weren't necessarily thinking about a urine culture, but then you see it there and you're like, oh, why not? I'll go ahead and order that. You know, people, if it's easy to do, might just go forward and order urine cultures. So actually just going through like preoperative order sets, admission order sets, or non-UTI related order sets and removing urine cultures can be really powerful. And studies that have looked at that have reduced culturing by half. So those are some very simple and I think kind of low-hanging fruit that pretty much every hospital should kind of review a lot of their order sets and make sure that what they have there is what they really want to have there. There are more powerful nudges that have been studied, which are really interesting as well. There was this one study that came out of University of Toronto by Jerome Lees. And what they did was they actually, if someone ordered a urine culture, instead of telling people what the result was, they actually popped up with a notice that said, most patients who have a positive urine culture when they're in the hospital have asymptomatic bacteria. If you would like the results of this urine test, please call the lab. And it left a number for the lab. And they reduced their asymptomatic bacteria treatment from 48 to 12%. I mean, huge drops.
That pop-up, is that pop-up just when they put in the order, or is that pop up when the culture results would come to sort of remind them to not order it next time? How does that pop up work?
So it was actually in the results field. So when the provider went to look at the urine culture test result, it said that instead of giving them the test result.
Now, if they called the lab, they would automatically get the results?
Yep. Yeah. And the point there is that it leads with that autonomy piece. So, you know, if you have a patient in front of you that is septic, or if you have a patient in front of you with dysuria and you get a notification that says that, you're like, well, I really want that urine culture test. I'm going to call. But if maybe you didn't even order the urine test, maybe it was one of your colleagues, or maybe you ordered it, but you didn't really think there was an issue, the extra hassle of having to call the lab is going to make you stop and think and say, you know what, that's okay. I won't call the lab. And that's what they saw.
So if the patient was getting better, then it's why bother calling? And if they were still not doing great, then more incentive to call.
Right, right, exactly.
All right, so I can imagine this can result in some cost savings and maybe freeing up the lab to do other things with their time than reporting cultures. Any other sort of measurable benefits that they saw here?
Yeah, so in that study, the biggest concern, obviously, is if you start hiding test results, is that you're going to have bad outcomes, right? Like maybe you're going to miss patients with a UTI. And so they did they looked for that really closely, and they didn't find any cases of kind of missed UTI treatment. And so that wasn't a big problem. And really, they actually saw that there weren't a lot of phone calls down to the lab. They were worried that they were going to actually have an increased utilization of the micro lab, right? Someone was going to have to be on the phone all day, like answering these questions. And they really didn't see that. And I think it tells us that for a lot of these patients with asymptomatic bacteria, if you didn't have the urine culture test result there with like the abnormal flag next to it, just being like, hey, you guys, this is abnormal. Every time you see that, that's a nudge in and of itself, right? Like if you have an abnormal flag next to something, it's like, oh, well, I should do something about that. And if you just take away that abnormal result, people are less likely to treat. So they didn't see any bad outcomes with any of that. And then with a lot of these other tests where you actually reduce the testing itself, you can reduce the cost of the testing and to the micro lab. So that can be one benefit. But then there's also the benefit and cost from just reducing the antibiotic treatment on the back end.
We're talking a little bit about asymptomatic bacteria, but what about some of these more complex cases, like someone with maybe just not acting quite right, you know, an elderly person who's, you know, mom's just not quite right today, that may just be worsening dementia, or even like catheter patients with chronic indwelling Foley's. What about for someone like that? That may just be like a worsening dementia. What about those scenarios?
Yeah, so I think the patient that you are bringing up right now is perhaps the most dreaded patient for both ER docs and then for, you know, myself as a hospital. It is getting the patient where it's like, great, you know, they can't tell me symptoms. I don't really know how they are. Maybe no one's with them, so no one can even tell me anything about their history. And so it's really hard in those patients. And we found when we looked at asymptomatic bacteria across the 43 hospitals that we work at in Michigan, is that the patients most likely to be inappropriately given antibiotics are those patients, you know, older patients, those with dementia, those with altered mental status. Those were the ones most likely to receive antibiotics, even though they were asymptomatic in all other ways. And, you know, the Infectious Disease Society of America guidelines that came out this year say that patients with dementia presenting with delirium, if they have stable vital signs, it's okay to wait. So if you have a patient who is not tachycardic, not hypotensive, and is a little bit altered, one thing that we know about patients, especially if they come from nursing homes, as they're older, if they have chronic Foley's especially, they're really likely to have bacteria in their urine no matter what. So if you went to a nursing home tomorrow and you looked at everyone's urine in that nursing home, most of them would be positive for bacteria. So when those patients get confused, it's likely that they probably already had bacteria in their urine. And if they're hemodynamically stable, you have a little bit of time to wait to symptomatically treat them, maybe give them a little bit of fluid for their dehydration, maybe make sure they're not constipated, maybe stop that new psychoactive medication they were started on yesterday and give them 24 hours to see if they're just going to improve, if this is just waxing and waning of delirium. And you know, studies that have looked at that in the nursing homes have found that that's a safe way to handle for these patients with stable vital signs. And in our study, we found that those patients, if they ended up getting treated with antibiotics, ended up with longer lengths of stay in the hospital. So they were actually now exposed to all of the harms of being in the hospital, almost an additional day for these patients because they were getting antibiotics. Now, I'm not saying if you have a patient who's delirious and comes in and they're hypotensive, febrile, tachycardic, that you should not send off a urine culture. So please don't ever quote me on that. You know, I think this is all about risk stratification. But what we do know is that a patient who is delirious but otherwise stable, you can do some of those symptomatic things and see if they get better before jumping straight to a urine culture, because that urine culture is probably going to be positive no matter what. And it's going to be really hard to tell whether that actually represents a urinary tract infection or not in those patients.
You're actually saying that you're seeing longer lengths of stay in patients treated with antibiotics versus those that are not.
Exactly.
Do you have any, not to get too far into the weeds, but do you have any idea on this paper as to how long this length of stay is that we're talking?
Yeah, so it was about a day increase, so from about 4 days to about 5 days for those patients. And the theory behind it, I think, and you know, of course, like the way we were looking at it, we're not able to actually know for sure why patients ended up with a longer length of stay. But one of the ideas is that, especially if these patients are, you know, chronically, intermittently getting antibiotics, because you know the cycle that we all see, kind of the nursing home to hospital, nursing home to hospital, each time with delirium, each time given antibiotics, and now suddenly their fifth trip back to the hospital, they don't just have E. coli in their urine, they have multi-drug resistant E. coli in their urine. So now we're waiting for their positive urine culture result. And then it comes back and it says, well, it's very resistant. So now you have to wait for to figure out what the sensitivities are before you can discharge them. So I think that's actually part of it, is the fact that, you know, once these patients, you've made the decision to treat them with antibiotics, you then have to wait to see what the sensitivities are. And those can take, we all know, a couple of days to come back. So I think that may be one of the mechanisms for why the length of stay is so much longer.
So next I've got two questions then. So it sounds like there's some harm in giving even just, you know, the first dose in the ED just in case. Because I think one of our big concerns is that we're going to actually prolong length of stays if we don't, which sounds like is quite the opposite. And two is, what was that educational piece like for the emergency department? That's sort of a big mindset change, especially in a conversation with the family. It's much easier to say they're not quite acting right because they've got a UTI than it is to say they're not quite acting right because they've got dementia and let's sort this out. So what was that education piece like? And sounds like you've made a pretty good argument for that there is some harm in one dose. And then if you wanted to paint a little bit more for that.
I think the education, there's never been a study that has shown that education works, you know, so to start with all of this, I don't think the education piece is ever that strong. That being said, we do it anyway, of course, right? And we talk to providers all the time and try to educate them on things. I think one of the key ways to dealing with families, which is kind of one of the pieces you've brought up, and I've seen that before too, you know, they're like, well, last time I came into the hospital, the doctor gave me antibiotics or gave my mom antibiotics and it made her feel better. Like, why aren't you doing that? And so there are some interesting things actually from the pediatric literature about how to deal with these patient conversations, because this happens all the time when a kid comes in with like a viral URI and you have very nervous parents and you have to kind of convince the parents that, you know, they shouldn't be getting antibiotics for this. And so the way I approach this with families is you actually start by, during the physical exam, kind of being like, okay, you know, there's no tenderness over the kidneys, you know, there's no tenderness over the bladder, like the abdomen is very soft. And you kind of bring home those points. And then I always say to the family, and this is easier to do when a patient's being admitted. I know it's actually harder to do if you guys are, for example, sending the patient back without doing things. But when I admit a patient to the hospital, it's often easier because I can say, you know what? I think the safest thing to do right now is actually not to give antibiotics, because I know that there can be harm with antibiotics. And there are no signs that I've seen so far that she actually has a urinary tract infection. But that being said, we're going to keep a close eye on her. We're going to give her some fluids. We're going to stop this medication. And I'd like to see how she does kind of with those things. And if necessary, we'll give antibiotics. But I'd rather not put your mom through that harm or that potential risk if we don't have to. And so I think framing the conversation like that, if someone brings up that like they've always gotten antibiotics in the past, I often say things like, yeah, and you know, I don't know if they were needed back then, but what I do know is that right now there are no signs of infection. And if we can avoid antibiotics, that would actually reduce her risk of having a side effect or getting resistance from the antibiotics. So, you know, if we can avoid that, I think it'd be great in this situation. But that being said, if something happens, if she gets worse, we're here and we're going to take care of her. So I think kind of making sure that setting the stage with the physical exam, talking about the harms of antibiotics during the conversation, which are often left out in conversations with patients, and then saying, don't worry, if things get worse, we will give antibiotics, so that they know that we're like keeping an eye on things. I found that to be a useful way to approach those patients who are used to being treated with antibiotics for this kind of thing.
So I think this sounds really interesting, and I like the concepts here. Tell me more about your local culture and how this was this something that was in place or in the process of getting started when you joined on, and how did the local culture evolve to becoming more accepting of this?
To be fair, there are many local cultures, right? So I work with a bunch of hospitals across the state. And even within my own hospital, you know, there's the hospitalist culture, there's the emergency room culture, there's the surgeon culture, you know, there's the 6B, this half of the floor culture. So, you know, it's very different. You know, it's a microcosm of a million people working together. And so everybody has a little bit different beliefs. I think one thing that we've found really helpful is to have a champion from the specialty represented. So, you know, I'm a hospitalist, I'm not an ID physician, and having me as a champion for not treating asymptomatic bacteria or for antibiotic stewardship is really great to help kind of move that across other hospitalists that I work with. You know, I can be up there kind of every day reinforcing this behavior. I'm a friendly face that people kind of recognize. You know, I think sometimes with antibiotic stewardship teams, you often have people come in and it feels like they're telling you what to do. And it's like, but they don't even know my patient or they don't even know what I'm going through. Whereas like if you have a hospitalist working with other hospitalists, they can say, you know, I know it's hard in these situations, but we've also looked at the data and this is what we found is better for the patients. And we found the same thing with our ER. You know, having an ER champion has been really great to kind of making sure that we're not thinking about things wrong. You know, maybe we're not thinking about workflow or, you know, completely missing some aspect of it that only an ER doc would kind of understand. So having those champions, I think, has really been helpful.
I want to go back to this piece about not taking away autonomy. I think that's a very excellent point and something that I haven't quite thought about much in the past, but makes a lot of sense. I'm curious how you got there. Is it something just by screwing up in the past, or is this something that you've sort of seen function in other capacities?
So two answers to that, I think. First is that, you know, the idea of the nudge to begin with, if we go back to, you know, Dr. Thaler's definition, is that you can't completely exclude any choices. And that's the beauty of it. You know, if someone feels strongly about something, if they really want to give antibiotics to a patient, you don't stop them from doing that. And as doctors, you know, we really don't like being told what to do. And so if someone is trying to tell us not to do something, that makes us really mad. So I think nudges are great because they help people who are at the borders. Like they haven't really decided if they're going to treat this patient or not. But if there's a nudge that makes it a little bit harder for them to give antibiotics, they'll be like, oh, okay, never mind. Let's not worry about it. So I think that's part of just the social psychology theory behind it, is that in general, trying not to completely tell someone what to do, that instead you should kind of nudge people, is better. It might even be better just to make sure that appropriate decisions are being made. But the other thing is that again and again in kind of science and in different studies in medicine, we found that if you restrict behavior, people will find a way to get around it. You know, like if you hate that order set, hate that alert that comes up, you will do whatever clicks you have to do, and it'll be garbage information just to get past the number of clicks so that you can bypass it and do what you really want to do. We found, for example, hospitals that restricted inpatient fluoroquinolone prescribing often saw more patients being discharged on fluoroquinolones. So the stewardship team thought that they were doing a good job of kind of changing minds, changing behavior, getting people not to prescribe fluoroquinolones. And it turned out that doctors realized that if you prescribe them a discharge, stewardship didn't know and they didn't yell at you. So they'd give a patient one thing as an inpatient and then discharge them on a fluoroquinolone. If you kind of try to beat doctors into submission, it never works because we're a very strong breed. So working with us instead and trying to, again, nudge people in the right direction instead of restricting their autonomy, I think is the most powerful thing to change behavior.
I feel very, very seen right now. So for those of us that might be in a community setting and interested in something like this to sort of gradually improve adherence to appropriate antimicrobial stewardship, What would be some suggestions that you would make to try to get like a community shop to get nudged in the right direction?
So I think step one is kind of the basic nudges that I was already talking about, you know, take them out of order sets, take them out of places where they don't belong. I think that is probably the lowest hanging fruit and isn't going to make very many people mad. You know, you want to make sure that when you start doing this stuff that you don't make enemies. And I think that is a really good place to start. And studies have shown it reduces inappropriate culturing by half. So great place to start. If you have a little bit more IT resources, for example, then doing some of these more complex nudges can be really helpful. The micro lab is often already kind of doing some of these things. If you think about susceptibility testing, you could report all 40 things that E. coli is susceptible to. But why would you report that it's susceptible to zoocin when it's susceptible to macrobid, right? Or nitrofurantoin. So what they do is cascade testing. And so they only report like a certain number of things. And so they're probably already doing that, but, you know, continuing to work with micro to do some of those things where if they don't want you to prescribe the fluoroquinolone, they don't report susceptibility to fluoroquinolone. So those are examples. Stronger nudges that require a lot more work that is great for outpatient and then for, I think, ED as well is peer comparison. There have been a lot of good studies that show rather than comparing people to the mean prescriber, you compare them to the top performing prescribers and you see everybody start to get better. So the problem with comparing people to the mean is those that are already doing really well are like, well, maybe I don't have to work so hard or maybe I could prescribe a few more antibiotics. So you compare people to the top performing ones and everybody kind of moves in that direction. So those are other really powerful nudges that have shown a lot of ways to improve in antibiotic use.
Anything else on asymptomatic bacteria or on nudging for that?
I think my final note is just that it's important to keep in mind that we're being nudged whether we like it or not. So, you know, often people are like, well, you know, this sounds like you're kind of manipulating people and you don't want to do that. But our system is already manipulating us. You know, if you go to your EHR and you pull down a drop-down menu from antibiotics, if it's listed alphabetically, they've shown studies that like whatever is top is more likely to be used. So instead of listing things alphabetically, list things by most appropriate to least appropriate. Doing defaults where the generic instead of the more expensive version is your default actually can reduce cost savings. So, you know, I think it's important to realize that we're already being nudged all the time. And so instead of allowing ourselves to be accidentally nudged just because that's how the IT person happened to do it, it's better to kind of do it conscientiously and think about how you can nudge people to make things more likely to be appropriate, whether that's antibiotic use or diagnostic testing or anything else that we do in medicine.
What a great ending to that podcast. Again, make sure to check out Patrick Bufuma and Dr. Valerie Vaughn when they come back on in February to talk about community-acquired pneumonia. But until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.